Whiskey.
Recorder so that we'll be able to
have a
recording this.
Tip, tip, yeah, no whiskey.
No, I'm fine. I'm fine.
Yeah.
I'm fine.
Did you walk from Bigwood?
Okay, well, in this very beautiful sukkah. So here we are on Sukkot, and the first thing, although it's the evening, the sukkah applies all the way through the 7 days, day and night. In fact, the 8 days here. B'chutz la'aretz, outside Israel. The lulav and etrog, we only shake only during the day. However, we've got some lovely lulavim here and etrogim to look at and discuss the significance of the lulav. So, would you like to show me yours? This is really beautiful. Lovely. Look at this beautiful lulav. And do you have an etrog there? Let's have it. That's so nice. Wow. Lovely. This is a very lovely etrog. Now, the reason why we shake it, normally we have it a little bit below. The reason why we shake the lulav and etrog, anyone, any suggestions why we do this? Is this a medieval custom or a late Kabbalistic idea from the 17th century?
It's pointing to the four corners of the world.
But when did we actually begin with this concept?
I suppose.
L'chaim.
This minhag was born in the diaspora after the destruction of the temple. I'm not so sure about it.
Any other suggestion? Well, it actually says in the Torah.
In the Torah.
Ulekachtem lachem b'yom harishon pri etz hadar kapot marim anaf etz avot v'ave nachal. It goes through a list of these four plants.
But etrog is not mentioned.
Well, it's called pri etz hadar, the fruit of the tree which is beautiful. That's one way of understanding it. And there is a tradition through the generations. What is the fruit of the tree that is beautiful? Is it a pomegranate? Is it a this? Is it a that? No, it's an etrog. The sages give a further explanation why it's called this. Pri etz hadar. Hadar can mean beautiful, and hadar can also mean which lives, like dira is an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Hadar, which lives be'ilano, it remains on the tree. And apparently etrogim are an unusual fruit. I'm not sure if they're unique, but they're unusual in that they continue to grow. If you leave them on the tree, they continue to grow. Apples stop growing.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they go moldy if they stay on the tree. Whereas etrogim, you can put a support under the etrog, and it'll grow and grow and grow. There are etrogim as big as footballs, or actually rugby balls. they come out of rugby balls. Well, all etrogim have the same level of being edible. That means they're highly edible if you make jam out of them, mm-hmm. and for that you need a good jam recipe.
It's almost like the quince. It's like a quince. You can't eat it.
Yes, you can't eat it raw. Yeah. Yeah, no, and they're very, very tasty. I mean, what you have to do, briefly, I heard my wife giving the recipe to someone just recently. No. You have to take out all the pips, which is quite difficult, and then you put it together with something like oranges as well,
mm-hmm.
And some sugar,
just like
no water, and just let it cook for several hours, and the natural pectin, which is in the
will
skin,
bind, yeah.
will bind it up and make it into a very nice thing. Extremely
so it's almost like a marmalade.
Yeah. Well, it becomes this. A thick marmalade.
With some jams, you would grate the peel to create the. So, are you putting the peel in? Or
oh yeah, you put the peel in. Yeah, sure. You put the peel. Yeah, you cut it.
That's what makes.
My wife's style is like thick cut marmalade. So thick
how
cut.
How does she call the marmalade?
Exquisite. That's what
they
call it.
Marmalade.
That's what I call it.
But so the sages mentioned
in the Bible
interpreted the as a drug.
Yeah, as the etrog. But it's a continuous tradition. I mean, it's the kind of thing that a nation has on a very long term basis. If you say there is this pasuk, this verse, which speaks about four different kinds of plants, and one of them, it's not obvious what it is, and they say, well, this is what it is. You
know, so why shaking it?
Ah, now then we have, so let's just see, then we have the kapot marim. Now kapot marim is interesting. Kapot marim means tamar is the date, so it's the date palm. Mm-hmm. But kapot, kapot means closed. Mm-hmm. So in fact this is the young palm branch, mm-hmm. because when it gets older the fronds open outwards, and so this is a young palm branch where they are still bonded together. When it gets older and it opens outwards, the dates form in between the leaves. That's the process of dates. And then we have Anaf Eitz Avot. Now that again, that's the Hadassim, and the words described in the Torah, they say the branch with thick leaves, and avot, which are thick together. So you can see this is the beautiful one, the way in which these leaves grow closely together. Now, the Torah is 3,300 years old, but in the Talmud, which is, and the Mishnah, which is 2,000 years old, it describes exactly that it's the hadasim, and what kind of hadas. It should be a kind of hadas which has got three leaves on each at each level, and it talks about it in detail and which kind and. And then we have the Arve Nachal. Now, Arve Nachal is a simple name of a plant, the willow of the brook, and so that is what we call in English the weeping willow, which often grows by a river. And so there we have it. And then Ulekachtem Lachem Bayom Rishon, the sages explain, what does it mean Ulekachtem? The mitzvah, the basic mitzvah, is picking it up, just holding it.
Netilah.
Just holding it. And the blessing is, Asher kedishanu b'mitzvotav mitzivanu al netilat lulav. God's commanded us to take the lulav. So the very fact of picking it up is expressing the mitzvah. Then comes the concept of waving the lulav. And here we have a very strong Kabbalistic admixture of understanding exactly what we're doing when we're waving the lulav. And so in order to understand that, we have to also understand what is the sukkah. And not only what is the sukkah, we also have to understand how Sukkot fits in with, well, we'll keep it there for demonstration purposes, if you don't mind. As long as it doesn't roll off. Chas v'shalom.
And then you lose the
pittim, yeah, that's right.
This is a disaster.
So you can get insured, but in the recent financial crisis,
because another people are yeah, because people are so obsessed with the perfection of the etrog.
Well, the Talmud says the etrog has to be perfect. You see, one of the concepts of the see, it says pri etz hadar, so there is the concept of hidur. Mm-hmm. Hidur means beauty. Particularly as in relation to a mitzvah, hidur mitzvah, the beautification of a mitzvah. So there are many things that are done in an extra careful way as an expression of hidur mitzvah, making the mitzvah beautiful. In the case of these arba minim, of these four kinds of plant, the hidur mitzvah is defined as a certain kind of perfection in the plant. And so there are, in fact, rules what constitutes an imperfection in the etrog or in any of the kinds which would render it pasul. And what is, it's a little bit of an imperfection, but it's still kasher. And what is the very highest, A1 alpha? So, for example, this etrog has a lovely, lovely shape. So each etrog, one can, contemplate.
Mm-hmm. But not having a pit will disqualify it.
If it was a kind of etrog which has a pitum, if the pitum is broken, that's a problem. But there are many etrogim which grow without a pitum, and they are perfectly all right. Now I remember a Hasidic gentleman that many, many years ago, he's passed away now, and I remember coming to him to buy an etrog from him. He sold etrogim, and I'm looking at it to see if it's beautiful, mm-hmm. according to the definition of the code of law. And he said to me in Yiddish, "Pitz dichob, make yourself beautiful." Never mind the etra. So that's.
We argue they're all made by God, so one shouldn't look too hard for fault in it.
Well, that's an interesting perspective.
It's a vegetarian.
It's God created beauty, and beauty in fact particularly relates to the 10th sphira, Malchut, the feminine sphira, and so that concept of beauty is itself a revelation of the spiritual in the way in which ultimately the feminine reveals the spiritual in a way of beauty. That the concept of feminine beauty relates to spiritual beauty, and spiritual beauty relates to the beauty of a mitzvah and to the beauty of the etrog and everything else which is in the lulav and etrog, and also in general in life, making things that are beautiful. A wife might bake chalot for Shabbat. They're exquisitely beautiful. There is something very, very beautiful about homemade chalot. In fact, all chalot are beautiful. But when it's being baked at home, there's an extra dimension of beauty. And even buying it from the shop, also there is a beauty about the way it's plaited, the way it's made. So there is this theme of beauty. However, let's go back and just see how this beautiful sukkah fits into the concept of the chain, the series of chagim, of festivals that we have at this time of year. Because here we are in the month of Tishrei, which is the seventh month of the Jewish year, and yet the beginning of Tishrei is Rosh Hashanah, the new year, and it's the beginning of a new cycle of spirituality. Because there is a divine energy which is flowing into the world, and that is flowing into the world every moment and every hour, and we can consider it as flowing into the world every hour because there is the tetragrammaton, the name of God with four letters, and the name with four letters has four there are how many combinations of four letters, four different letters? What's the mathematical number of different permutations, like A, B, C, D, A, C, B, D, D, B, C, A? How many would combinations would four have?
24.
Yes, that's right, Alexander. 24. The way you work it out is you say what's called 4 factorial, 4 times 3 times 2. So if it was 5, it would be 5 times 24. So 4 times 3 is 12, times 2 is 24. So there are 24 different combinations of the name Yud-Ke-Vav-Ke, and that represents the energy which is flowing into the world in the 24 hours of the day, each with a different combination of letters. So there is a flow of spiritual energy coming into the world all the time, but in fact that is renewed each week, each month, and particularly each year. It's a kind of a spiral going higher and higher and higher. And at the beginning of the year, on Rosh Hashanah, on the new year, there is a new burst of spiritual energy flowing into existence for the benefit of everyone. the Jewish people have the kind of ceremony in which they are blowing the shofar and praying and doing different things, but all that is in order to bring about a new burst of energy for the new year, for the entire world, for the whole of humanity as well. It's not only an individual concept, or even one which is just for the Jewish people. It's regarded as something which has universal relevance. Now, that flow, which comes from, in fact, it's understood as coming from the blasts of the shofar. The call of the shofar is reaching. Shofar is a very interesting concept, because it's this simple ram's horn, which is as if it's a calling from the depths of the heart, or from the depths of the soul. And it reaches to the most exalted depths above, and draws down a new flow of holiness into the world, giving life force to the world. Now, that's in a very serious mood on Rosh Hashanah, and it becomes even more serious on Yom Kippur, where we actually fast. And of course, the key moment on Yom Kippur is when the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, goes into the Holy of Holies with a pan of fragrant incense, and he puts the incense on the coals in the Holy of Holies, and there's this fragrant smoke which is there in the Holy of Holies. Now, and that is a meeting point between the individual and God, between the whole nation and God, and between each person and the divine. Now, that is all on what is called Kav HaGvura, the line of severity. Because the line of severity is where we're being very serious, and we are looking at, we look over our lives over the past year, or maybe our entire lives, and we find all kinds of little problems. And and we try to, unfold those little folds or untie those little knots. And it could be that the knot that we successfully untied 3 years ago, now that we look at it with more clarity, we see it's still got a problem. Mm-hmm. So that's the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur mood. But that is the Kav HaGvura, that's the line of severity, the left-hand line. The line on the left. Mm. Which is a reaching towards the divine, a reaching away from our earthly situation towards the spiritual. But then comes, after Yom Kippur is finished, so this is a beautiful time, because then, in fact, we've achieved atonement in some way. We've come so close to God. There's the concept of a mikveh, a ritual pool in which a person bathes and becomes purified. And on Yom Kippur, it's as if we have entered so close to godliness that we have become purified. And the idea is that then from Yom Kippur onwards is suddenly a new mood, a mood of joyfulness and of chesed. The line, not the left-hand line of severity, but the right-hand line of kindness, of love, coming out, being expressed as joyfulness. And so then we come to Sukkot 4 days later after Yom Kippur. And the sukkah is a very spiritual dwelling, because we're really sitting now, this is a lovely sukkah, and we are sitting in a kind of a spiritual, it's a spiritual realm. And the Kabbalists speak about the sukkah as representing the Sfira Bina. Mm. Now we have Keter, which is the crown, that's mm-hmm. the highest level, which is often so exalted we don't even count it. And we start with Chochmah, wisdom, and then understanding. Now, wisdom is like a lightning flash of a revelation of the divine. Understanding is where that lightning flash is absorbed inside the person's mind, and he or she starts thinking about and exploring it this way or that way, which can be an ecstatically beautiful experience, which might take place, for example, in contemplative prayer, if you have persuaded the caretaker not to lock the synagogue when everyone has gone, and you're able to stay a little bit longer, and you know, sing quietly to yourself. You have to be very careful nowadays, you know, people think. Especially with a financial crisis. You know, call an ambulance. But in fact, there are synagogues where such contemplative prayer is very common, and where they even have, both in Kfar Chabad in Israel and in Melbourne, I've seen it in the Chabad synagogue in Melbourne, they have a special little room just for people who want to take time out to pray in a much longer way,
mm-hmm.
and after the end of the regular prayer service, mm-hmm. to really enter into a kind of more spiritual realm.
And in Los Angeles.
And in Los Angeles. That's beautiful. That is beautiful. That's wonderful. Yes, the very, very spiritual person was the founder of Chabad in California, Shmuel David Reichchik. And extremely spiritual and charismatic person. So I can imagine that was part of the picture over there, or is part of the picture. So so that is the so now so Binah, understanding, can mean this sort of ecstasy of contemplative prayer. But the Kabbalists also say Binah represents Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden.
Mm.
So it is a spiritual realm where there is some kind of revelation, because the spirituality which is there in the lightning flash of Chochmah, of wisdom, is somehow revealed in understanding. See, wisdom is seen as a glimpse,
mm-hmm.
like a eureka. Yeah. And then you flesh it out, you think about it, and you know what painting you're going to paint, or what poem you're going to write, or it crystallizes in your mind. And that is a very, very joyful experience as you explore in Bina. Now, the Sukkah represents this Bina. So it's got this very, very spiritual dimension to it. Now, how does that relate to the ordinary way in which they teach children in Cheder that the reason why we sit in the Sukkah is because when the Jews came out of Egypt, we dwelt in Sukkot? Well, it relates to it in the following way. Can anyone tell me? How do we relate the spiritual interpretation of the Sukkah that I've just been presenting with the standard way in which we learn, and which in fact is written in the Torah, that God put the Jewish people in Sukkot when they left Egypt, and that is why we keep the festival Sukkot now, which is written in the Torah, that there is a festival, mm-hmm. about eating in the Sukkah, dwelling in the Sukkah. Any suggestion?
If you look for a reason why God put those that left Egypt into Sukkot for those 40 years into the wilderness, and then translate that into our own lives and say that we still have that journey to make, then that would bring the two together.
That's a very lovely idea. That sense, I mean, that applies both to Pesach and to Sukkot as a personal journey that each person is making.
Mm-hmm.
That's yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But to underline the way in which the Sukkah in that journey has a spiritual dimension,
it's a return, isn't
more
it?
Than
you're coming back to yourself, and at the same time in a higher level. Isn't that to do with that?
Well, this is when true.
Leaving of Egypt is also the kind of freedom or liberation, which you could say liberation from your ego, or you could say liberation from the things. It's getting what?
Very cerebral.
Cerebral.
Is it?
Cerebral.
Is that
then I think you better have some more whiskey.
That's the problem, I didn't have any.
Now, oh, well, Michael, what do you expect? either the whiskey will enhance the physical and show it as being more cerebral, or it will bring the cerebral down to earth.
Yeah, but sukkah,
not for nothing is it called spirit.
Yeah. Here we go.
Yeah, I was going to say the sukkah is associated not only with sukkot. You know, the phrase sukkah is mentioned several times. Sukkah David, Sukkah Shalom.
Nachon.
Sukkah has been compared also to chuppah, in a way, sheltering people, not in the physical sense of the word.
So what about the whole newness about it? There's something, well, you could just mention, like, if it's mentioned in different places, and I just, like, imagine chuppah even. Like, there's something new, something new life, something clean and coming together.
Does, well, to be honest, the plants,
contemplation and giving a new flow, so it's kind of, I don't know.
No, that's you see, one way of understanding what the way the sukkah is made, the sukkah is made in an interesting way, that it's the leavings of the harvest. This comes at the end of the harvest. And so at the end of the harvest, there's a lot of straw lying around the field. So straw would be a perfect substance from which to make the schach of the sukkah. The way in which it's defined, you see, the sages analyze the artifacts that we use in our daily life. And there is a very interesting dividing line. There are things that can become impure. They might be pure at this moment, but they could become impure. And then there are things that cannot become impure. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a tree which is growing cannot become impure. There may be a problem if someone worships the tree as an idol, but basically...
What happens if the tree becomes diseased?
It doesn't make it impure. It might mean that you, you know, you have a botanical problem or an agricultural problem, but it doesn't make it impure. If you cut down the tree, it still doesn't become impure. If you take the tree and you cut some of the wood and you make it into a wooden cup, then it's already a vessel. Then it's an object. Mm. With an inside and an outside, and it can then acquire impurity. So the concept of what we use for the roof of the sukkah is something which grows from the ground, which has been cut off from the ground, but which has not been made into any utensils so that it could acquire impurity. So therefore there's a certain freshness, as you say, to everything which is there, a certain spiritual quality that it cannot acquire impurity. And that underlines the spiritual dimension. Now, you mentioned the different sort of spiritual uses of the word sukkah in the Bible, which is absolutely right, the sukkah of King David. In fact, in the Grace After Meals, we include a prayer that God should raise the Sukkot David Hanofele, the Sukkah of King David which has fallen. In other words, representing the kingship, Davidic kingship, the coming of the Messiah. That's all there as well in this concept. So at the end of the, just before the Amidah, on a Shabbat and a festival, we ask God, spread over us the sukkah of your peace. Very beautiful words. Frosalenu sukkat shlomecha. That's a beautiful phrase. Spread over us the sukkah of your peace. So there is this idea of the peace within a sukkah because of the sukkah being able to hold everyone. There's even a phrase in the Talmud, Uyin kol Yisrael, it would be fitting for the whole Jewish people, leshev b'sukkah achat, to sit together in one sukkah, as if you had a gigantic sukkah with air conditioning and all kinds of other modern things, but the entire Jewish people would be there in that sukkah.
Yeah, that would be peaceful.
at least 1 week a year.
Yeah.
Because we can't sit next to each other during the rest of the year.
I always understood, and that's Sukhashlam Mohan, that as being almost, not even more than a shelter, but a protection. It's like, almost like being under the wing, of God's wing as a shield.
That's a beautiful way of seeing it. That's a beautiful way of saying.
Yeah, because sukkah comes from schach. Schach comes from sukkah. The sochech in Hebrew.
Yes, to shelter. To shelter something. The sochech, yes. That's right. Now, there is one way of understanding what the sukkah literally is in the story of going out of Egypt is that it's huts that the Jewish people made when they were traveling from Egypt to Israel. They dwelt in huts. They made huts and they dwelt in those huts. In the Talmud, there's a discussion about this, and one opinion is, yes, it's huts. Another opinion is, it's not huts. Over the camp of the Jewish people in the desert, in the journey from Egypt to Israel, there was a canopy of something else. What was that canopy? Over the whole nation.
Oh, Amud Aish.
There was Amud Aish, right? There was a pillar of fire, which was a pillar of fire at night and a pillar of cloud during the day. But what covered the whole Jewish people? You said it just now. Ananeha kavod, the clouds of glory. There is a concept that there were clouds of glory covering the entire camp of the Jewish people as they traveled through the desert, and because of that it wasn't too hot in the day and it wasn't too cold at night, and there were many positive aspects to these clouds. So that is a kind of a spiritual protection, and the sukkah represents that cloud of glory. So there is the cloud of glory, which is the clouds of glory which surrounded the Bnei Israel, the Jewish people, in that journey. And the schach of the sukkah. Now, on the one hand, schach has been linked through a gematria to the 100 blasts of the shofar that are blown on Rosh Hashanah. So ideally, in general custom in most synagogues, they blow, it works out, 100 blasts of the shofar. They blow 30 at this point, 30 at that point, 30 at another point, then another 10. So it adds up to 100. That's the usual synagogue custom in England and many other places.
Oh yeah, 60-20-20. Yeah.
Now, in the blowing of the shofar, there are three different notes, quite right. So tekiah, that's the long note. There are 60 such notes altogether. That is shvarim. There are 20 of those. And that's truah. There are 20 of those. Samach is 60. Chaf is 20. And chaf again is 20. Schach. That's the schach of the sukkah. The 60-20-20 of the blast of the shofar. So therefore the blast of the shofar, which is reaching to the divine and drawing this extra quality of spirituality into the world, that becomes manifest in some sense as the schach, as the covering of the sukkah. And another point, in the last few minutes talking together, there are two occasions where we talked about a cloud. One was the clouds of glory of the Jewish people in the desert, but another cloud was mentioned.
The pillar of clouds.
The pillar of cloud. Okay, that was in the same phrase,
yeah.
But a few minutes earlier, nearer the beginning of our little discussion, cloud, fragrant cloud.
Oh, the incense.
Yes.
The
cloud of incense that the Kohen Gadol brings, the high priest brings on Yom Kippur into the Holy of Holies. So the sukkah also represents that cloud of incense. So it's as if we're sitting inside the cloud of incense in the Holy of Holies, but instead of it being something which is so mufshat, you know, so abstracted from ordinary life, it's become a place where we can sit and have excellent whiskey And that is all part of the mitzvah of the sukkah, to sit in the sukkah, to eat, to drink, to enjoy oneself, to sing, to play. That it becomes, this exalted spiritual dimension becomes part of our physical reality. And so what we are trying to do in the sukkah is bring this spirituality here into our world.
There's some peculiar clouds outside, actually. from the plains, stripes.
Very beautiful.
A whole lot of stripes across the sky. It's quite
maybe they're trying to make a kind of airborne sukkah.
Yeah. A cloud made to order. I wonder who was the sage.
I heard of someone who they had to travel in El Al. They had to travel to Israel or from Israel on Sukkot. And in all seriousness, they phoned up. They asked their travel agent, can you see if there's a sukkah on the plane? So he contacted the airline, you know, is there a sukkah on the plane? They said, we'll find out.
So is it a true story or a joke?
I heard it as a true story. I mean, at some point, someone must have said,
Yeah, but sukkah can never be in an airplane.
Well, you couldn't. You could have one,
but it defines.
Yeah, you could have on a little Piper jet or something, where Piper plane where you're sitting in an open.
In the open.
Yeah, you could. That's
convertible.
I do remember flying on LA a long time ago, and they made the point of asking people not to all pray at the same time because the plane isn't designed for of the 300 people. 200 them, so you're all going to the back at the same time.
That would make sense.
That would have to have a few minyanim simultaneously. I was wondering who was the sage who cracked the gematria formula. How could he, you know, reach this comparison? You know, he needs to be genius.
Well, the point about the gematria is they are passed down, and they are a spiritual, discovery or revelation of two great sages of the past. There is a work called Baal HaTurim, which is a commentary. There's the Tur. There is the Tur by Rabbi Yaakov Barab Asha.
Yeah, there is a street named after him in Jerusalem.
Right, yeah. And there is a commentary on the Torah by him, which is called the commentary of the Baal HaTurim. Now, in this commentary, there are many gematriot. So, in fact, here is a copy of the Torah. And here we have Baal HaTurim. Here is a little commentary. In fact, it's a much longer commentary, but they, because much of it was very similar to Ramban, I think, what they did was they cut it down to what is particularly new about his commentary, which is these gematriot.
The shrinking.
And so he gives a lot of numerical correspondence.
What was his name?
Yaakov Barab Osher.
It does seem sometimes some of it's done in humor. Rather than
today there are many humorous gematria, yes, and there are many festive occasions like a bar mitzvah or a marriage, so someone works out the name of the
Now it's easier to do it because of the computer.
Then you have computers, that's right. There are computer programs. You can type in any word or phrase and it'll give you the numerical value, and 500 other words which have the same. Yeah, but in fact they are spiritual dimensions. Now that sukkah shlamecha, that concept of a sukkah of peace where there's this intense spiritual radiance which is coming down, flowing down and becoming part of our physical lives, that also relates to the four plants. And the four plants, the Midrash tells us a number of ways of understanding what they are. For example, they could be imagined as part of God's name, and that in some sense they together they make the name Yud Ke Vav Ke, the four letter name of God. So you have the four plants together, and so by holding them together, one is somehow making the name of God one. Like we say, Bayomahu Yeh Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad. On that day, the name of God will be one. God will be one and his name will be one. So the idea of unifying the name of God. And we also have this concept that Teshuvah, repentance, is Tashuv Hei, Yud Ke Vav, is unfortunately separate. The Hei has fallen aside in some way, which is like the Hei of our own soul, which is not so connected because of a few little mistakes which we didn't need to do anyway. But we are working on it.
I thought that holding it together also forms letters. I can't remember which, but
This is one way of understanding it, that we are uniting the divine name. So that's one way. Another way of understanding it is that we are uniting the Jewish people, because each member of this four has got different qualities. This is from the Midrash. Like the etrog has got a nice taste, as discussed with the recipe, and it also has a nice fragrance. Yes, the etrog, generally the typical etrog has a nice fragrance. So, not always, sometimes modern etrog, with the
depends whether they've been genetically modified or not.
It may well. So that's taste and fragrance. Then we have the lulav. The lulav produces dates, so it's got a nice taste, but it doesn't have a fragrance. The hadassim, on the other hand, the myrtle,
has a fragrance
but no edible fruit. And the arava, the willow, looks very nice but does not have a fragrance, and it doesn't have a taste either. So taste is compared to Torah study, because when you study Torah, it's like you're absorbing something. V'toratcha b'toch me'ai, your Torah, King David says, your Torah is inside me. You eat Torah almost. There's physical food and then there's intellectual food, but the food of Torah becomes part of the person. So the Torah is like food. On the other hand, mitzvot, doing good deeds, being a kind person, giving charity, helping someone, other mitzvot are like fragrance. And also there are negative mitzvot, which we shouldn't transgress. Doing something that we shouldn't do is like the opposite of a good fragrance. So, and there's a story in the Zohar about someone who hadn't done a certain mitzvah, and it's mentioned that someone could tell that by the odor, the fragrance, the odor of your clothes. I can tell that you didn't do whatever you were supposed to do. It's a passage in the Zohar. So you see, there is the idea that around each person, from the good deeds that we do, there is the fragrance of the Garden of Eden, and from the bad deeds that we do is the negative odor of Gehinnom, of hell. So there are positive and negative fragrances, which are an expression of what we do.
So mitzvah has an odor?
Sorry?
Mitzvah has an odor?
A mitzvah has a positive, beautiful odor, So, in spiritual terms. Now, so therefore the etrog, which has got the taste and the smell, represents someone with learning, great learning, and also dedication to mitzvah as well. So, both qualities. Such is the Jewish people that you might have others who, they study a lot of Torah, but they're not so much into mitzvah. So that's like the lulav. And then you have the hadassim, that might be an emphasis on good deeds, but they don't get so much time to study. And then you have the arava, the willow.
They just lick it. And they have a part to play.
That's right.
I've met those people.
Now, the interesting thing is, we take, ulakachtem lachem, you take all the four parts. They all have to be there. You can't say, I'm only going to use etrogim, or I'm only going to use the etrog and the lulav. You've got to have all four, including the arava, the willow, which doesn't have either quality, but as you said, they look good. So you need every dimension, and in a sense, they're every dimension of ourselves as well. We have these four qualities, these four possibilities, but they can also be seen as the whole of the Jewish people. And so there is this unification of the Jewish people. That's the spreading over of the canopy of peace. And so there is this sense of a peace in which we are all unified together for a week. As long as... and also there is the shaking of the lulav. Now, if I could just... you see... What are we actually doing when we're shaking it? And if we look at Kabbalistic teachings about this, what we are doing is, it's imagined as if one was shaking the lulav and etrog in the sukkah. It doesn't have to be like that, and one couldn't shake the lulav and etrog anywhere, but if it's easy to do it in the sukkah, there's an extra dimension, shaking the lulav in the sukkah. Because it's as if there's a surrounding radiance above us and around us. And by shaking, what we are doing is we are drawing that spirituality into us. Mm-hmm. So I remember watching the way the late Lubavitcher Rebbe would shake the lulav. And it was like he would like shake it like that and then draw to him like three times in each direction, and very slowly and deliberately, and it was as if something was being elicited from this surrounding spiritual radiance, and then from above, and then from below, and then at the back. So if one starts off, there are different customs of how exactly to do it. So one way is east, south, west, north, up, down. That's what the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch says, the brief code of law. The Chabad custom is to the southeast, to the northeast,
northwest.
To the
southeast, northwest.
No, southwest. No. Southeast, northeast, like to two corners, then east, then from above, then from below, then southwest twice, and west, the final one. And that relates to the idea, on the one hand, the east is towards Jerusalem, but also in the west is the divine presence, Shechina b'ma'arav, the divine presence is in the west. And so there is this, the basic thing is that we are surrounded by spirituality and drawing it to us, and it doesn't really matter which way one shakes, but that concept that one is drawing a flow towards one into us as individuals, into us as the Jewish people as a whole, into us as for humanity as a whole, universally. Because the concept of Sukkot is seen as something which draws life force for the whole of humanity into the world. And that is connected with what happened in the temple on this during this festival, where 70 bulls would be offered in the temple. And the sages tell us the 70 bulls correspond to the 70 nations of the world. And so a spiritual energy is being drawn into the world for the Jewish people in Israel, in the land of Israel. And from the land of Israel, it spreads over the whole world to all the 70 nations of the world, who are seen as the original 70 nations, and from them we get the many hundreds of different peoples and languages that there are today. But it's seen as coming originally from the 70 nations. And so there is that flow which is coming into the world as a whole, and so it's a whole process which begins with Rosh Hashanah, and it moves through Yom Kippur and then into Sukkot, bringing this warmth and radiance and love into the world for the benefit of everyone, with also the sense of rejuvenation. And we're now entering the winter period, but then it's going to become, and there's going to be rain, so we have a prayer for rain on the so on Shmini Atzeret. Here in England it's the penultimate day of the festival, and then we have Simchat Torah, which in England is separate. In outside Israel it's two different days. There is the rejoicing with the Torah. We've gone through one cycle of the Torah, and then we're beginning a new cycle all over again. So that is the atmosphere of Sukkot, and this very special occasion that brings us all together into the Sukkah over here.
Happy note. It's a happy note.
It is a very happy note.
The fact that you have the 2 days Pesach and 2 days, first 2 days Sukkot, and Shavuot, was kids were told because they weren't quite sure the date to be sure, they did the 2 days. On that basis, we should, outside of Israel, you should be fasting 2 days for Yom Kippur.
Some people do, but not for that reason.
Surely that's not valid today.
They never suggested that we should fast 2 days for Yom Kippur.
But the idea that
you see, the other way of understanding it is that I mean you're absolutely right logically. You're quite right there. See, there's the idea of a decree that the community can't keep, so the sages are wise, and that's why they're called sages, and they don't make the decree. But there's another way of looking at it.
So I'm just agreeing.
In Israel, which is a very spiritual environment, you could say you only need 1 day of a festival. Outside Israel, where there are many challenges for the Jewish people, you need an extra day, an extra festive day. So this may be a component in the whole idea of having extra festive days outside Israel, whereas in Israel. I mean, you're quite right that it's a tradition based on the fact that originally they didn't know which day it was, and so they kept 2 days. Now we have a calculated calendar, which was worked out very cleverly around the year 400, and we're still running on that same calendar. So when we buy a little Jewish calendar telling us, you know, when Hanukkah is going to be and stuff
So why not abolish the second day for the diaspora?
Well, many people have suggested that, but the response has been, this goes back 1,000 years, right? The response has been that we keep it as a custom which reflects the tradition of our ancestors, whether they were in Israel or out of Israel, continuing the same tradition, or from that particular locality, that there is a significance. You might say it helps to maintain the awareness that this is England and that is Israel, that is the Holy Land. Wherever one is, there's an awareness, and every festival one is able to sense that. But also, the positive way of looking at it, that the extra festive day gives another day when one is experiencing some dimension of spirituality, which outside Israel you need that extra input.
Rosh Hashanah is 2 days also in Israel.
Yes, because even in Israel they didn't know exactly when was, because the uncertainty was when the new moon was sanctified. So Rosh Hashanah is actually on the day when the new moon is sanctified, so only within Jerusalem would they really know before the time of telephone.
So Jerusalem is 1 day and the rest of Israel is 2 days.
Well, what became the custom was everywhere is 2 days.
In Purim, you know,
Purim is a lot more complicated.
Jerusalem is almost comes second to the rest
yes.
of the world.
Yeah, yeah, because...
Because of the wall.
Yeah, yeah, that's the walled city. Yeah, yeah. And so then, completing the Torah, which will take place next Wednesday here in England. In Israel, it'll be on Tuesday. But here in England, it'll be on Wednesday that we complete the Torah at the very end and then begin again from the beginning. And that's where we come back to our little study circle where we are reading the beginning of the Torah. And if we just spend a few minutes on that, shall we? Just, because we have reached a very special day. We've reached the seventh day. Yeah, Tuesday night and Wednesday. Sorry. Thank you so much.
But Charlie, what was the origin of Simchat Torah?
Well, it's interesting because originally there were two systems of reading the Torah. And one system took 3 years and the other system took 1 year. And there is an ancient concept of making a festive day when one completes something of Torah, and especially the reading of the Torah scroll. So
this is more a custom than
it is. A rule. Yes, it's a custom rather than a rule. But then the interesting thing is that you see Shmini Atzeret, there are 70 bulls offered during Sukkot, and then comes the festival of Shmini Atzeret, the final festival, which is the eighth day, which is also the day of Simchat Torah. In Israel it's one day, and in outside Israel it's two separate days. That is a bit like Ne'ilah on Yom Kippur. Ne'ilah on Yom Kippur, Ne'ilah means the locking of the gates. And it's sometimes explained, it's the very end of Yom Kippur, and it's a very spiritual moment, and it's sometimes understood that the gates are being closed. But the Hasidic explanation of it is, the gates are closed, and you are inside the gates with the Divine. It's a point of unity, of intense unity with the Divine. And Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah are seen as having the same quality. This sense of unity with the Divine in a joyful way. There's it's very spiritual on Yom Kippur, but it's still very serious. Whereas on Simchat Torah, it is intense and joyful. And so there is that movement from intense spirituality in a serious vein to intense spirituality in a joyful way. And so then we have the beginning of the reading of the Torah, and we will be hearing on Simchat Torah itself, on Wednesday morning, they will read, first of all, the end of the very end of the Torah, Bezot HaBracha, and then they will read the creation, the account of creation, and the account will go day by day. Now, if we could look, please, at page 7 and 8. You can find page 7.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. You've got it. Right. So we read day by day, and then the person reading the Torah, he comes to words, Vayarekim et kol asher asah, and God saw everything he had done. Vehinei tov me'od, it was very good. Vay erev vay boker, yom hashishi, and it was evening and it was morning, the sixth day. Now I believe it's quite a common practice for everyone in the synagogue to then say the next paragraph before the reader of the Torah. And everyone says, Vayechulu hashamayim va'aretz v'chol tzva'am. Heaven and earth. Would you like to read it, Oksana?
Here. Heaven and earth and all their components were thus completed. with a seventh day, God finished all the work that he had done. He thus ceased on the seventh day from all the work that he had been doing. God blessed the seventh day, and he declared it to be holy. But it was on this day that God ceased from all the work that he had been creating, so that it would continue to function.
Right. Now, the translator, in fact, is wrestling with the subtleties which are there in the Hebrew. And so, first of all, there's the idea of Vayechula Shemaim Va'aretz V'chol Tzva'am, the heaven and the earth and all their hosts were finished. So they've been finished in the 6 days. And then Vayechal Elokim Bayom Hashvi, God completed with the seventh day Melachto Asher Asah, the work which he did. So in other words, the seventh day is the real completion. Everything was made. But then there's another step which is needed. And it's that step of Shabbat. That step of the seventh day. Now, in terms of the Sfirot, you have Chesed, kindness, Gvura, severity, Tiferet, or mercy, Racham, Netzach, victory, Hod, submission, Yesod, dedication, and those are the 6 days, and then Malchut, kingship, the Shekhinah, the feminine. And you can have the whole structure, and if you don't have the feminine, Malchut, there, then the structure feels it's incomplete. And then you have that moment of completion, which is Shabbat, the Queen Shabbat, so to speak. And that quality of completion. And then that is Vayishbot, that is rest, that is divine rest in the sense of the cycle coming back, the whole process of energy, of creation, which took place during the 6 days, now comes to a moment of total fulfillment, in which the world that God has created becomes an expression of the divine. And that is really what Shabbat, what is happening on Shabbat, that the divine is being manifest in our physical world with human beings, men and women, food, practicalities, a home, children, and there is an expression of the divine. Vayavarech Elokim et Yom HaShvi'i, God blessed that seventh day. Vayakadesh oto, he made it holy. And so we make the seventh day holy. We declare it holy by women lighting Shabbat candles. We declare it holy by men saying the bracha of kiddush on wine. If there's no man, then a woman makes kiddush. If there's no woman, the man would light the Shabbat candles. But ideally, it's the woman lighting the candles and the man making kiddush. And also, we represent the end of Shabbat by making Havdalah, which is also a moment of saying something over a glass of wine and with a Havdalah candle and spices and so on. Because on Shabbat, God ceased from the work which he had created, which Asher Bara Elokim, which God had created, La'asot. Now this very last word over here is a difficult word, and the translator struggled with it. He said creating so that it would continue to function. That's how Arya Kaplan, Alav Shalom, that's how he translates it. But there is another way of understanding it. God created the world in an incomplete way. We're stopping soon. The temperature is... God created the world in an incomplete way, and we have to complete the world. And that's the bit which is left for us as human beings, to complete the world. In fact, there is a translation, Asher bara Elokim letaken. Not la'asod, to do, but letaken, to put right. As if there is a flaw, there are certain, that's it, to fix it, that there are things which need fixing. The very idea of human nature, where there are such problems within human nature, everything can be right, and yet for some reason there are all kinds of difficult issues which lead to conflict, to crime, to war. And that is the situation around the whole world in an amazing way. That is a process which we have to litaken, and also one could say litaken to put right in practical terms as well, that there are many things to be developed. And we will conclude with the fact that on Motzei Shabbat, during the 6 days of creation, the radiance which shone was the radiance of the first day of creation. God said, let there be light, and there was light. Then the sun, moon, and stars were created on the fourth day. And so now you've got another kind of light as well from the sun and the moon. But when we come to the sixth, to Shabbat, it's still shining the original light of the first day. That is the light which was still shining. Then came the end of Shabbat, and that light of the first day disappeared. And also, it was now night, and so it was dark. The sun had set, maybe the moon was visible, but it wasn't very light. And so Adam, he took two something or other, and he beat them together, and he produced fire. And so that creation of fire, we remember every Shabbat with our Haftarah candle. So that idea of fire, artificial light, was needed at the end of the first Shabbat. And that's what we celebrate with our Havdalah candle every Saturday night. So I wish everyone a wonderful Sukkot.
Thank you.
And a wonderful Simchat Torah in every way.
Yishar Koach.
Thank you.
So Simchat, the eve of Simchat Torah is Tuesday.